Recently, I was at the Glasgow International Film Festival, one of the many fine film festivals that take place here in Scotland throughout the year. And I had the opportunity to see this film, Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay. And the interesting thing about this film, it wasn't about so much the magic of Ricky Jay and his skill as a man who deals with cards and sleight of hand and deceptive practices, for lack of a better term, and magic, you know, he deals with magic. But the interesting thing was very much in that title, which is, it's not just the mysteries of Ricky Jay, but it's the mentors. And I began to think, you know, what it's like growing up and how important mentors are to people and to young artists, but I guess also to just young people in general, no matter what field you're in, whether it's computer science or archaeology, having people who you look up to, who kind of take you under your wing if you prove yourself enough, if you show you're engaged and keen to learn about a particular field, how important those are. And I thought how lucky I've been with the podcast that we've been doing to talk to some of my favorite writers and to get a chance to have real friendships and actual moments of learning from people who I really respect. And something that really came out in the film about Ricky Jay, which was how important it was for him in his career to meet people who not just taught him tricks, but taught him how to be, you know, a professional magician. And it's amazing. And so with that in mind, we sat down with Molly Bernstein and had a great conversation about this film she put together with Alan Edelstein, about Ricky Jay himself, about his history, his background, and of course, about his many, many mentors and what kind of influence they had on his life and work.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls, casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
My name's Molly Bernstein, and I am the producer, director, and editor of Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay. It's basically the story of Ricky Jay's life in magic. For those of you who don't know who he is, he's considered the best living sleight of hand artist in the world, and he's also an amazing historian of magic. So the film really traces his apprenticeship starting from age 4 with his grandfather, who was an amateur magician, going into his adulthood. And he had all the different mentors and people he studied with, and especially in his later young adult life, he had two mentors that were incredibly important that were quite unusual characters that he spent a lot of time with. So the film is really Ricky's story, but told through this lineage of sleight of hand artists that he descends from.
The real key to learning is almost like the sensei-master relationship in the martial arts. The way you want to learn is by someone that you respect showing you something.
And what I want you to do is watch me actually shuffle the cards and see that it's a good, legitimate shuffle. Because after all this shuffling, I'm going to do what gamblers call dead cutting an ace. The concept here is you reach into a shuffled deck and literally cut out an ace. This is an acquired skill.
I'm wondering how hard as a director it was for you to get involved in that scene. Because this is, you know, when people talk about magic or illusion, sleight of hand, there's a lot of tricks that people, and they're very hesitant to reveal them to each other even, never mind somebody from the outside. So I'm wondering how you got in and how secretive they were towards you as a person who was like, tell me more about this.
Well, it took a long time actually to, you know, Ricky says in the film, one of his mentors, Charlie Miller, didn't, you know, warm to him quickly. It took a while. And then he says, as it should. So I'm familiar with that gradual process. But basically, you know, I have a co-director, Alan Edelstein, who's not here, but neither of us knew anything about magic, which I think was good in a sense. And we also learned very quickly not to be interested in method and how anything is done, because in, you know, Ricky says people should know how effects are done on a need-to-know basis, meaning if you're doing a theater piece or a movie or you're a performer and you really need it and you're going to use it, then you should learn it. Otherwise, it really spoils it for you. If you're just someone who is watching and appreciating magic, to learn how really, you know, it takes a lot away, and you shouldn't really want to learn it if you want to keep enjoying it, unless you're a practitioner. So we were happy. We were just very interested in him as a character and in the subculture and the history of these people. But it was incredibly challenging to do a documentary about an artist, you know, whose process you cannot film. Because, you know, normally I've done a lot of portraits of artists, actually. And normally, you know, you go to their studio if they're a painter and you see them painting and they talk about their process. So it was unusual and challenging. And he did not warm to us quickly. I mean, it just took a while to get to know him and to gain his trust. So it was gradual, but it was really rewarding ultimately to do it over a long period of time. It took us over 12 years to do the film. I mean, very on and off, because we all were doing different things, and Ricky's based in LA, we're based in New York. We all had all different projects going, so it's not like a continuous 12 years, but it wasn't
reticent for 12 years, was he?
No, he wasn't. But it did, you know, it really did evolve over that time. Somewhere in the middle, I would say, he really got more engaged in the project. Until then, I think he was kind of tolerating us, you know.
Do you know why that happened? What switched? Was it just a confidence with you, or was it more, because he speaks at one point about how shocked he is that people like Di Vernon aren't around to train the younger generation anymore. It seems inconceivable to him that people could be growing up without ever having seen these people perform live or having spoken to them or learned from them. Do you think he had a sense of the importance of the film became about sharing that kind of lineage and sharing that mentorship? Do you think that switched at all?
Yeah, and actually I think that was really why he agreed to do the film in the first place. It was very important to him to pay tribute to them and to introduce them to people. You know, they're not well known at all outside of the magic world, but in the magic world they're really legendary and brilliant performers, and he spent so much time with them, and I think he realizes how special that was and really wants to share that. So, and actually it was really very early on when we said, well, let's focus on the mentors, that did get him to agree to work with us on the film. But I think it turned out to be a really nice way to get into who he is, because it is such a huge part of his life, or maybe is his life. You know, he's so passionate.
Going back a little bit to reveals, I guess, magic seems, it's a super interesting art in the sense that, you know, you have this, what astounds people in terms of like the performance is different than what, like, if you heard about it, like, okay, I had to practice 134 hours a day. I had to learn that if you shuffle a deck four times, I had to memorize the deck. You have to do all these things, which is equally stupefying and astounding in its own right, you know, but you never share that with the audience. And there's this moment in the film, which is really interesting, where David Mamet says, you know, Ricky said to me, go away and learn this trick better than me, and then I'll teach you another trick. And Mamet, of course, never does it, and he gives up on the whole notion of learning the methodology, which I think I would do too, because why would I? You could tell me exactly how you solve a Rubik's Cube, you know? And I would never learn how to do it. But I'm equally as impressed by the ability for somebody to do it, even if I know the engineering, the mechanics of it, mm-hmm. as I am by the fact that they can do it in a minute and a half. And I wonder, like, was it just that notion of, hey, if you really need to know this, then you'll learn how to do it. And then you'll come back to me and show me, and I'll be able to show you something else. It was right. Just that, is that the kind of thought process you had when you decided we were not that interested actually in the methodology?
Well, I think they're two different things. I mean, certainly Ricky's worked with Mamet on a lot of films and consulted as well as acted in them. So I think he's definitely revealed cons and certain techniques to Mamet when it is part of a story they're telling in a movie, like House of Games, or Spanish Prisoner actually came from a real con that Ricky, you know, I think it was 17th century, that Ricky found in his research and told David about. So I think, you know, that's sort of the need to know when you're using it for entertainment or drama or, you know, a real purpose, then that's, I think he would consider that need to know. But the other is really revealing to somebody the mechanics of sleight of hand. there are just so many layers of it, and I guess that Ricky really feels, unless you're really willing to work at doing the first step brilliantly, then he's not going to take you to the second step. I mean, that's, you know, I guess he just has incredibly high standards, and even if you're his great friend, like Mamet, he's not going to quickly bring you in as a student.
Do you think knowing the tricks or how they're done, like knowing that the answer actually does ruin it? Because I there's a part of me that just thinks, well, if I know how hard somebody worked on something, that's a different type of special. It's a different type of astounding, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
If you think about it, it's like, how does it compare to a brilliant violinist? I mean, that's something where you can watch them practice, or you know that they practice 10 hours a day or whatever for their whole lives. And that doesn't take away from a brilliant performance, right? But the fact that the practicing, what a performer is actually practicing in magic is how to fool you. You know, you don't want to, the less you know about what they're practicing, the more fooled you can be. And it really is a delightful thing to be fooled. If you really, you know, if you enjoy that, then you'll be happier not looking for the how.
Yeah, because there's a drag to be like, oh, no, yeah, well, there was a mirror there.
Right. Although, of course, no mirrors are involved in the film or any of Ricky's magic.
Though there is a mirror, though. There is that mirror where he sits in front of a mirror. He does sit in front of a mirror in the film.
That's true, but it's not a trick mirror. It's a mirror that you see, you know. I want to, you know, no trick photography was used in the making of this film.
People frequently talk about how much more difficult it is to cheat in a card game than to perform good sleight of hand. But if you think about it, what makes magic different is that it's inherently honest. You tell someone you're going to deceive them before you deceive them. In some way, that makes it more difficult.
You focus a lot on the hands and on just him just shuffling. And there's a beautiful calmness and a music to it. And it's different. Why did you decide to focus on that so heavily and so repeatedly?
I think because, you know, part of what we were really interested in showing in terms of Ricky's character was the obsessiveness and the dedication, you know, to this art. And also that he says, you know, it's like a meditative tool, sitting and practicing and shuffling cards. He also says in the film that that's what calms him down more than anything else, if he's upset about something or, you know, is to just sit with a deck of cards. So it just seemed like it's the perfect action for, or metaphor for, you know, for what he does and who he is, in a way.
Were you hypnotized by that as much as I was watching it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm always hypnotized anytime I see him do anything, but there was something about getting really close with a camera that footage is, it's very powerful, I think, being able to just see his hands almost, you know, at your point of view, and very more close up than you would in a theater, or even sitting next to him at a table. So, and it's funny, he sort of thinks that stuff is boring, you know, and everyone else tends to love it. You know, same with him sitting in front of the mirror practicing. To him, it's like, eh. But we, the filmmakers, and almost everyone who's seen it, all really love just seeing that repetitive action of shuffling and handling the cards. So,
and he's able to do that, you know, that perfect, I guess, that perfect shuffle, right, where the cards fall the same way every time. He totally controls the deck, right?
I'm not sure about the details. I do know that he's, let's say, an expert in card control.
What is the secret to his? You talk about magicians, and there's a lot of them out there, and there's some that are well known, and there's some that are lesser known. But Ricky seems to have done this thing that, like, still in the world of magic and illusion, but he's taken that and transferred it into the larger culture. He's done work with Paul Thomas Anderson on Magnolia, which I didn't realize until today when I found out that's his voice. That's his voice in On Magnolia, which is great. He's the narrator. You know, he's been in Deadwood. He's on the Rogues Gallery album, which is produced by Johnny Depp. What's the secret of that? And then in the old days, of course, big fan, you know, big on the talk show circuit with, like, Steve Martin and Dinah Shore and all this stuff that's in the film. And I just thought, God, that's so rare. It's such a rare person who can go from this kind of relatively underground culture to a bit more mainstream, and not in a schlocky way or a cheesy way, but in a really genuine artistic way, and take that and transfer it. It reminded me maybe of, like, I don't know, Ginsberg or something like that, who was able to go from that little poetry scene to the world stage really amazingly. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, that he's just an incredibly charismatic performer, and, you know, he's able to carry that beyond his specific art, you know, of magic. And it's funny, he always tells the story that when he, in the first years of knowing Mamet was teaching an acting course at NYU, or maybe it was in Chicago, and said, "Ricky, would you come and be a guest, you know, teacher in my class?" And he said, "What are you talking about? I don't know anything about acting." And Mamet said, "Yes, you do. Everything you do is acting." So there's a funny, you know, and I think he talked about it yesterday too, that it's not a heavy methodology, I guess, in terms of acting, that Mamet's very interested in a more natural or less studied, I don't really know actually about his method, but I do know that Ricky has not trained formally in any way as an actor, but he's been performing his whole life, and that's what you see in our film. And I think he's just got this amazing presence that carries over into other genres really well.
That immensely talented people gravitate towards that, yeah?
Right. I mean, he, you know, for example, Paul Thomas Anderson cast him in Boogie Nights. I don't know if you remember, he was the cameraman in Boogie Nights. And we interviewed Paul, who's not actually in the film, but there's an extra on our DVD that's an interview with Paul about Ricky. And he says that he had seen him in House of Games and he thought he was a thug. You know, he thought, where did they get this guy? Did they pull him out of jail or something? He was, you know, and then when he found out he was Ricky Jay, a guy in LA, you know, who had an office actually near where Paul was living, he was just astounded, went to his office and said, you know, he really begged him, would he be in this movie? And he wasn't auditioning him or anything. He just, after seeing House of Games, he thought, that's like, I really want him in my movie. So he has that appeal. He has that strength as a presence, as a performer, as a character that, you know, a lot of people really gravitate toward.
Yeah, and maybe this is weird to say, given that he's so shrouded in mystery and so much of his life is, but a super authentic character as well. It seems very real. He's not putting on a mask, right?
That's what I think. I mean, I think part of the reason that he's so powerful as a performer is that there's not a big separation between him and who he's playing. And I think that's what really appealed to me about his performing style when I first saw him in his one-man show, Ricky Jay and his 52 Assistants, was that it's really him. I mean, he's performing magic, but he does it in the context of talking about his passion for the art and what in the history of the art has inspired him and excited him. And he just does it in this very genuine way that isn't that different from when you're interviewing him or sitting down with him at lunch and talking. I mean, there's not a lot of separation, I think, between, you know, I think he is himself most of the time, in that he's just a fascinating person, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. How did you fall into the orbit of Ricky Jay?
Yeah, I saw that performance of 52 Assistants in New York, and it was in a tiny theater of about 100 people, packed with, you know, an adult New York audience, and people were gasping. I mean, I just had never experienced anything like it, and it was just this guy sitting on the stage with a deck of cards, and it was extraordinary and brilliant and beautiful, really, because he brings to life these historical characters and these historical effects, but he also talks about his personal connection to them. And so it's not just history or just magic or just, you know, a monologue. It's all of those things together, a personal monologue. So it was really extraordinary. And then So that intrigued me. I really wanted to know more about him. So I started reading his books, and I dug up Mark Singer's profile that he had written, and that's really what made me think, oh, this would make an amazing film. And it's actually Mark who was instrumental in introducing us to Ricky and encouraging Ricky to work with us. And he's been great. He's a executive producer on the film, and the film is inspired by his article. So it's very much in that, the tone of that article. And he has been amazing to work with also, and is a good friend of Ricky's as well. So.
Molly, thank you so much. And it's a fantastic film, and I think everybody should go out and find it. It's going to be on DVD soon, or it is already?
It is on DVD, and which you can go to our website, which is rickyjmovie.com, and find information about how to buy it or rent it or download it.
Thanks, Molly. It was a fantastic film, and it was really good of Molly to step up for that interview. We were supposed to sit down with Ricky Jay, and he couldn't make it that day, so we didn't get a chance to meet him, but Molly was really excellent to talk to about the film, and everybody go check it out. It's available on Netflix and many, many other places. I didn't get a chance to talk to the co-director either, Alan Edelstein, but he very kindly put together some reflections on making the film with some stories, some coincidences, and some convergences about his work and Ricky Jay's work. So here he is, Alan Edelstein.
Hi, my name is Alan Edelstein. I'm the co-director and producer of Deceptive Practice. It's not surprising that a magician like Ricky would be interested in coincidences, in chance happenings, in synchronicity, whatever you want to call it. Magicians are fascinated by this kind of thing involving probability. And this long production, a film that we did on Ricky, took a long time. And over the course of the production, there were quite a few instances of coincidence. My favorite one had to do with a line that Ricky says about his mentors. He's talking about, I believe it's Cardini, one of his favorite magicians of the earlier generation, and talks about his life on the vaudeville circuit, the form of entertainment where you traveled around the country. It was a grueling schedule of performances. And what he said about these guys really echoed something that had been said in my first film, which was also about a vaudeville performer, a musician named Roy Smeck, where you could make a living going house to house doing your act. He said it almost word for word in the same way. But even though I didn't have a background in magic, either as a performer or enthusiast, both Molly and I were fascinated with the history of entertainment and the character of these people who were driven to perfect their act and perfect their skill at whatever strange thing it happened to be. The essence of the statement was that you could, in those days, you could make a living going from vaudeville house to vaudeville house doing an act that maybe took 5, 7, 10 minutes. But it was something that you, as a performer, you were consumed with perfecting. And if anything else, vaudeville was a kind of school for performers. It was a way of honing one's craft night after night. In a different town with a different audience, these performers developed a way of understanding how to connect with an audience. The performer that I had done a film about years ago was Roy Smeck, and he was a great string instrumentalist, ukulele virtuoso. And the great irony of his career was that he became a star by appearing in one of the very first sound films ever made in 1926. And it made him a star, but it was also the thing that would eventually kill off vaudeville. And later television would put the final nail in the coffin. With the mass media, you had audiences who were seeing your act all over the country. All at one time, so you didn't have this whole system that had grown up around live entertainment, traveling from town to town, was subverted by the new media, and all these performers that had made a living previously were were all of a sudden out of work. If you did your act once on Ed Sullivan or some other TV show or appeared in a film, people were now going to see this all over the country at the same time, and you would no longer have the kind of system where you could keep this going night after night. We were delighted to screen the film in the UK earlier this year. We had screenings at the Dublin Festival and in Glasgow. We're hoping that in the future it will get a wider audience there. More information about the film can be found at rickyjmovie.com, and we're hoping that the DVD and download will be available to UK fans in the near future.
That was Alan, just reflecting a bit on Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay. You can check it out on rickyjmovie.com. There's loads of places to see samples and view trailers, but of course you can get the full film available widely online and hopefully at a cinema near you soon. Thanks to Molly and everybody else at the Glasgow International Film Festival. I had a brilliant time there, and you'll be hearing more from the Glasgow Film Festival on our podcast very, very soon. Until next time, this was The Culture Laser.
The question was I ever tempted to become a con man or a card shark? Yes.